You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, March 18th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Matt Stoller on the lost history of free trade agreements in this country. Also on the program today, yes, ladies and gentlemen, one more billionaire comes out and claims that we are headed to a Nazi-like state because of all this talk of income inequality.
Yes, mein Sieger. We will struggle against the inequality.
Also on the program today, another, I don't know if he's a billionaire, but he's pretty darn close. The head of Netflix and a fairly liberal guy is another one of those multimillionaires who thinks that because they have multi-millions, they know what is best for education. And apparently they don't spend a lot of time talking to educators. As he says, that California has got to pick up the pace of charterizing, privatizing their school system. We will get into that more on the Chris Christie front. A couple of stories that have broken today and over the past couple of days to show just how corrupt the Chris Christie administration is, or was. Also on the program today, a new climate report released, and the Congress reverses the one thing that it did that had even the slightest bit of, I guess, providing some accountability for climate change. And Al Jazeera has supposedly a report on what might be in that CIA torture report that the Senate Intelligence Committee has not yet released. And the feds make a quiet but big move on medical marijuana. All that on today's program. We'll get to the interview with Matt Stoller in a moment. We pre-taped that last week. Just a quick note. Apparently, there's been a helicopter that crashed in Seattle right by the Needle, and at least two people have died. Getting more during the course of the show, we will let you know. And you probably already know at this point that Putin has announced on the, I guess, in the wake of the referendum yesterday in Crimea, that they're going to go ahead and annex. And the United States and the EU have issued relatively minor sanctions. A couple of dozen people, I guess, who can't travel to either one of those locations and have their bank accounts frozen to the extent that they didn't already get their stuff out of those bank accounts that would be frozen. I suspect that there's some really busy bankers in the Caymans who were up all weekend in anticipation of that. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Matt Stoller. Really interesting stuff that Matt has been researching. And, of course, this stuff is very relevant in light of the TPP and the EU partnership, both of which seem to have stalled for the time being, in part because there's been such strong pushback to the notion of fast-track authority. Just a reminder, Reid and Pelosi have both said fast-track is dead for the time being. The latest rounds of talks on the TPP, I guess about a week and a half ago, failed to come to any type of conclusion, in part because it was quite clear that this was not going to get rushed through the Senate and the House, which disincentivizes the various players in the negotiations to come to terms. But I think one thing that we can glean from the research that Stoller has done is these aren't going to go away. And this is part of a it's sort of fascinating, the story of all of this. Maybe I'll tell that anecdote afterwards. It's not terribly insightful, but well, I'll tell it now. Several years back, I guess this is now about 20, 25 years ago, which gives you a sense of just what has happened to time in my mind. But I was a big Somerset Maugham fan and had been reading, I believe it was, of Human Bondage. And at one point in the book, the phrase, "a Rolling Stone gathers no moss," was presented as a pejorative. And I think for people in my generation, I had always perceived that as a positive. I don't know the idea. You don't want to gather moss. And I remember my grandfather at one point, I think it was when I was leaving law school, said the same thing to me, "Rolling Stone gathers no moss," as a pejorative. I don't know what a stone wants with moss. But this history of free trade reminded me of that dynamic, because much of what initiated free trade had some very positive attributes, even though the shell of it would accomplish what is attempted to be accomplished today by the TPP. When you listen to this interview, I think you'll get a notion of what I'm talking about. All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Matt Stoller. Back on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Matt Stoller. He is writing at observationsoncreditandsurveillance.tumblr.com. Matt, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thanks a lot.
So now the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and its sort of cousin, trade deal with the EU, has been in the news as of late. We don't know too much of what's in either one of those trade deals because it's been negotiated in secret. What we do know is that as of today anyways, or I should say over the past couple of weeks, both Reid and Pelosi have said they're against fast-track authority, and which at the very least inhibited the last round of negotiations. So for the time being, it appears that those trade deals are not moving forward. But the writing you've been doing on the origins of so-called free trade should make it clear to everyone that these things aren't going away.
Right. I mean, this trade regime has a long history that goes back to the 30s, actually.
Now let's talk about you write about this, about the Atlanticists.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tell us about that. Let's start in the 1930s.
Well, so I've sort of started going back in the congressional record and looking up random things to find out when the first mention of various agreements or ideas were, just to see what members of Congress were saying at the time. And one of the things I found this really strange committee hearing, I think it was in the 50s, on a proposal to combine the U.S. and Western Europe into one country called the Atlantic Union, or Atlantica. And it was strange, and I read it, and then I learned that there had been a bunch more hearings like it in the 50s and 60s. And that this notion was taken somewhat seriously, and the people behind it created things like the European Union, NATO, OECD, World Bank, and so forth. And that this was a position that's kind of been whitewashed out of history, this idea of a world government, but it really did exist, and it was held by a fairly large number of liberal elites.
Yeah, you talk about a book called Union Now by a guy named Clarence Street from 1939.
Right. Yeah.
I have to say, I got to read this quote because I enjoyed it so much. You write, Street's idea, though it sounds outlandish now, was mainstream in the 1930s, somewhat similar to Tom Friedman's Lexus and the Olive Tree, only with less stupid elites.
Yeah, I mean, so Street was a New York Times guy who covered the Treaty of Versailles and World War One, and he saw what happened, and the Treaty of Versailles and the attempted creation of the League of Nations made a huge impression on him, and he then saw the occupation of Manchuria by Japan and Nazi expansion, and his conclusion in the late 30s was that there needed to be not just some sort of League of Nations, but a real political union of what he called freedom-loving peoples, and which included freedom like countries like South Africa, but also Western Europe and the United States. And so I think there's definitely some questions about the racial makeup of freedom in Street's concept, and George Orwell took issue with that, actually. But the basic concept was, you know, you have these international crises, and there were also a fairly significant number of financial crises that were about international capital flows. And Street was like, the way to deal with this isn't to create necessarily an IMF, which is what we eventually did. It's to just combine everyone into one country. And then out of that, and there were a number of different ideas around that. Street wasn't the only one pushing it, but he was sort of the one who was kind of the non-socialist pushing world government. There were other strains of thought that eventually did turn into our modern system of trade agreements, which were basically developed in the 60s and by a guy named George Ball. And his idea was that that it would be a global government by multinational corporations. And it sounds much more ominous and evil than it was at the time, because at the time you have to recognize that nationalism had just caused, you know, the Holocaust and a massive world war. And so his idea is we have to find some alternative to this parochial nationalism. And one of his strategy was to try to move trade agreements through to integrate countries economically, and then ultimately you'd have multinationals making decisions about resource flows, and that would reduce the propensity for war. So that was the idea.
I mean, I'll walk through that a little bit more, but what's so fascinating about these, it's a two-part series, at least at this point, on your Tumblr, is that, you know, we can see, you know, this idea was born out of that notion that you had two world wars. The world was a fairly nasty place. And by the same account, too, you know, multinationals weren't necessarily the type of multinationals they are today. They were certainly not benevolent, but they had different implications. And so walk us through this. So George Ball, who was George Ball specifically at that point? And you know, then sort of take us through what you found in terms of Rockefeller and sort of how this evolves. We have this sort of idea about a one world government, or at least a one world unified via trade, that has, you know, that in some ways we see all the good stuff sort of dropped out of it. and today, yeah, we've got the bad stuff. But walk us through.
To be fair, there hasn't been another world war since,
right,
so far. So it's not all bad. There we are, me defending the global trade arrangements. That's not what I meant to say, but you know, there were some things that have happened that have been reasonable, and it was actually a reasonable strategy. I would agree with it, but there was, you know, the European Union. I mean, a lot of the idea here of American international architects of global society was to prevent France and Germany from going at it, right? Because they had done that in, you know, twice within the span of you know, a few decades. And millions of people had died as a result. And so what they said was, let's just combine them into a union. And originally it was called the Iron and Coal Union or something like that. And it was France and Germany would be integrated economically, and then eventually they'd be integrated politically. And they effectively have been integrated economically at this point. And nobody really talks about the idea of a war between Germany and France. It's just not thinkable. And so in that sense, these architects succeeded, and they, you know, the European Union was a result of this strain of thinking. But George Ball was an undersecretary of state, and but more than that, he was a friend of John F. Kennedy, and he was a member of that kind of elite establishment. It's less important what the bureaucratic positioning is, and more important how close they are with the president. And Ball was pretty close with Kennedy, and he wrote he's also known as a dissident on Vietnam. He came out against the Vietnam War fairly early within the administration. And but he wrote the Trade Act of 1961 or 62, which was the authorizing legislation that allowed the U.S. to negotiate the what was called the Kennedy round of trade talks in the mid to late 60s, from 64 to 67. And these were the first trade talks that dealt with non-tariff barriers to trade. So most trade talks originally in the 30s had dealt with tariffs like the Smoot-Hawley tariff, and they thought of trade as shipping goods back and forth. And what Ball thought was, well, there are these things called non-tariff barriers to trade when countries structure their laws to keep out certain products without tariffs, or when they just structure their industries that are not basically amenable to the needs of multinational corporations. Those are things that we have to deal with. And then in the...
Can you give us give us an illustration of what a non-tariff barrier would be?
Well, so the one that Ball was trying to deal with in the 60s was called dumping. They had dumping provisions, and that's when, a country will subsidize steel industry so that it can have a steel industry, and then it will sell steel exports at a loss, with the government effectively making up the difference. And that's called dumping, and it's a strategic approach by a country that wants to build up certain economic sectors. And so the Kennedy round was about allowing countries to impose anti-dumping provisions. Another example would be, like, I think you have this problem with Japan and auto imports. If you want to import cars into Japan, you not only have to deal with tariffs, but you have to deal with dramatic amounts of inspection for what they say are safety reasons, and then you have to get into their dealership system, which is very closed. And all of these institutions are designed to keep out, I don't know why they're designed, but they have the effect of keeping out imports into Japan. So that's a non-tariff barrier. And you can go through, and there's a fair number of them. But another way you could think of a non-tariff barrier to trade is actually as a question of sovereignty, right? I mean, Japan wants to structure its auto industry the way they want to structure it. And if you start to say that's a trade barrier, then you're starting to say that the way a country organizes itself is a trade question rather than a sovereignty question. And this is some of the stuff that they got into, and this is some of the stuff that we got into with regards to NAFTA and the TPP and other trade agreements. And what I've shown and what George Ball really did say is that that was actually the point. This wasn't about economic efficiency. This was about reducing sovereignty so that there would be a more peaceful world and a world that would be run by multinationals.
And we should say that, you know, in today's day and age, you know, things like, you know, I don't think they were so prominent. Well, certainly back in the 60s, you know, environmental regulations wouldn't have been so prominent.
Intellectual property, things like that, yeah.
But now when we talk about non-tariff barriers to trade, it is environmental protections, let's say,
right,
or labor protections, or, you know, I guess the example of the inspections on the Japanese card would be considered consumer protections, all of which are manifestations, theoretically at least, of the will of the electorate as
right, like one of them is
mediated
was a World Bank case brought against the U.S. for country of origin meat labeling, right? And Canada and Mexico said that the U.S. demand that we actually label the meat that you get with the country of origin, that that's a restriction of that's a restraint on trade. So that's like where you take these questions of non-tariff barriers to trade. They become absurd, and they just become questions about how do you make sure that multinationals get to make as much money as they want and hide information from consumers or other producers in the market.
Now, was his agenda specifically to diminish sovereignty, or was that sort of a byproduct? Because you quote him as saying that business decisions could be frustrated by a multiplicity of different restrictions by relatively small nations that are based on parochial considerations. I guess he is going after sovereignty because, but the dynamic too at that time, I mean, do you have a sense of what he would have had in mind in terms of small nations with parochial considerations, and what were in his mind sort of grander ones? I mean, because,
well, to fulfill the full, so this is kind of his peacenik view of the world, and I don't mean peacenik in a bad way. I just mean that it was about, for him, it was about, he did become an investment banker later, but the ideology was around what's good for the banking, what's good for the sort of financial multinational sector is good for peace. So it is the ability to look, and this was actually a pre-World War I mindset too, so it's not like Ball came up with it, but it is the ability to look over the world and freely survey all sources of production that is enabling man to enjoy the world's finite stock of resources with a new degree of efficiency for the benefit of all mankind. But to fulfill its full potential, the multinational corporation must be able to operate with little regard for national boundaries, or in other words, for restrictions imposed by individual national governments. So that was his idea.
And so, to be clear, he's talking about, like, we can get rid of, problems like famine, and we can get rid it's hard for me, to place where he is historically, but when he says we must move in the direction of common fiscal concepts, a common monetary policy, and a common ideas of commercial responsibility, give me a sense of, like, what he would have imagined in those different silos. Specifically, like, what do you think his, in his mind, because, again, this gets to what's so fascinating about your piece for me, is that, over time, certain ideas can change. We still see the shell and the structure of the idea, but because it's been filled with something different, it has much worse implications. I'm curious as to what common ideas of commercial responsibility Ball would have thought were back at that time versus today.
Well, I don't know what Ball thought about responsibility for. I think his thinking probably evolved in his life, but at the time in the early 60s when he wrote the Trade Act, I mean this. When he said this, it was 67. It was just after that round had completed, and the world in which he was living was one that was guarantee that was sort of operating under the Treaty of Detroit. At least I say the world when I mean the domestic populations within America. The Treaty of Detroit was a solution to the labor disputes of the 30s, 40s, and 50s. There were massive strikes up until probably the late 40s, and the auto industry and UAW conducted a series of agreements that allowed for cost of things like cost of living increases, automatic cost of living increases, pensions, healthcare, and raises, annual raises. And this was an era when the middle class was broad, and the idea was that you have a consumer economy where you have a strong middle class, and corporations and unions both bought into it, with corporations, of course, being the senior partners in the arrangement. But the reason they bought into it is because they could, there really wasn't any international competition, and so they could just pass on cost increases through their exports and to consumers, and so they didn't really care about paying labor more because they that didn't impact their profits. And so, but it was a much better world in if you were living in the United States and were in a protected class. It may not have been a better world if you were not in the United States and you were not in a protected class. But that's the way that Ball thought about it at the time, and there was more support for a free trade agenda because free trade was considered not only in the benefit of American multinationals, but also toward, you know, it helped the, or it was considered to be helpful to the American middle class.
And on some level, I mean, maybe I'm reading too much into this, but if that's his baseline, he's what he's talking about when he says common ideas of commercial responsibility, he's basically saying, theoretically, we would make what we're doing the baseline for all other, well, I guess in his mind, he wants them to be quasi-nations, but we would raise the baseline for the rest of the world. In terms of labor standards. And like I say, I don't think there was too much going on in terms of environmental, and maybe even consumer standards weren't even necessarily really in focus at that time. But that's the sense that I get, is that this guy really thought that he was, there was sort of an enlightened, there's something missionary
about it, right? I mean,
they
did think that. They thought that there was a, I mean, look, let's be clear. These guys were about a club. Right. It was a club of people who ran the world, and George Ball was in the club. It's just that their club was, you know, incorporated a basic concern for normal people, not necessarily for good reasons, for strategic reasons. But that's what they, you know, that's they had a vision of a world in which the American middle class was treated reasonably well. Today's club, which uses the same or like similar rhetoric as George Ball did, doesn't really consider the middle class particularly important one way or the other.
And so. that's how we get something like the TPP, right? I mean, you spoke to the new I guess the chief trade negotiator
Michael Froman.
I mean, tell me he's the US trade representative.
They're not aware of Clarence Street's history in the Atlantic Union, but they, you know, the trade people I know, they very much understand George Ball. George Ball was the is a really important figure. He actually, the 1962 Trade Act created the office of the United States Trade Representative, although it was out of the White House. It was a White House level position at the time that Ball created that. So they're very well aware of his ideas, and you know they draw from those ideas. They draw from Ball's tradition. And Ball comes from the multinational world. He was, I think he then went on to be an executive at, I believe it was Lehman Brothers, but I'm not sure. And so it was, you know, they see themselves as part of the same club. I also think that there was a national security angle to what Ball was saying too. And there was this belief that America had an industrial base, an industrial commons that was a competitive, not only a competitive advantage, but it was a national security asset. Our ability to make things was important in terms of our ability to project power. And I think that one of the things that's happened, particularly after the Cold War ended and you saw things like NAFTA and the opening of the WTO to China, is that our national industrial assets are no longer seen as particularly useful. It's changing a little bit, but they, you know, people see our banking system as the national asset that creates competitiveness. And they're also not seen as particularly significant in terms of national security. So what we've done is we've given away huge amounts of technology in our industrial base to other countries under the idea that, you know, was pushed by Clinton and Bob Reich and a whole bunch of others, that this will create a more peaceful world, a better world. In fact, in 2012, Russia was granted most favored nation status. This idea just keeps marching forward that giving away sovereignty, is a way to create a better world. And I think it's time for re-examination of it. But in order to re-examine it, we actually have to understand what the guiding ideas behind these trading regimes are.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that it really strikes me. Tell me, like, what is most concerning for you in that regard? I have my sense of what is problematic in terms of,
I'm most worried about the national security stuff, even though it's more, obviously the middle class, the economic arrangements are important. You know, if Russia wanted to, they could just say, we're dependent on Russia for our space flight to the space station, right? So if they wanted to, they could just say, no more trips to the space station for you, and we can't get to the space station until whatever, 2018 or 2019, which is how long it'll take us to build to build and test and run a new rocket. And NASA's a good analogy because NASA, we started cooperating with the Soviets in the 70s as a way of saying, well, let's find a way to create peaceful relationships. And then we decided at some point that, well, it's okay. We can be dependent on Russia for our space travel. And it's fine because we're all friends now because we're after the Cold War. And we didn't bother to plan for it. We knew this was coming. And so now the only way to get into space, manned spaceflight, is to pay Russia. And they have a monopoly and they keep raising the price. But also, they can just say no at any point. And, it's a good metaphor for the way our elites have changed. That's why I call this elite somewhat stupid, because they don't think about basic problems like what happens if Putin doesn't want what we don't, if he doesn't want what we want. That situation is beyond imagining for them. And that's ridiculous. And it's really dangerous.
When they imagine, in that example, what is it possible they just say, the cost associated with that is limited, and in other words, we could support our own program that would remove that leverage from Putin, but you know what? It's like insurance; it's just not worth the downside risk. Is just not worth it in that case.
Well, they're not even thinking about that. They're just sort of like they're not thinking about leverage necessarily, or at least if they are, they're not. They're certainly not. It's not coming into play for them. But I, that's just a simple example. A better example would be the fact that China makes most 90% of the vitamin C in the world, which is technology that we developed and then we sold it off to China. And vitamin C is used as an important food preservative, and they make a lot of our antibiotics. They make a lot of chemicals for medicine, not just iPhones and all sorts of other things that we need. And if China just decided that they didn't want us to have any more vitamin C, we wouldn't.
Right. So we're just not developing the manufacturing capacity because we just don't see.
We're giving it away. That's the problem. Is we're giving away. The reason we're doing it is because the people who the descendants, the intellectual descendants of George Ball, think that the world is a frictionless. Globe for capital, money just flows around the world, and that's what's important is tracking that flow of money. And it's not. It's also stuff moves. Money's important. The banking systems are important, but stuff is also important. Stuff is what we eat. It's what we use to do things with, and it's ultimately what keeps us alive. And the fact that we had an industrial commons to actually build all that stuff and assemble it, and we had redundancy in that industrial commons, and we had ways of sourcing things from multiple places, and we knew how to run it, was meaningful and important. And that was ultimately the point of antitrust laws, was to manage that strategy. And through our trade laws and through our reductions in antitrust enforcement, we've put ourselves in a really dangerous position.
And so, when we saw there was that campaign where they had that ad where there was a Chinese guy in front of an audience, I guess, of in the future of Chinese students, and they were talking about we own them because we have their debt. Really, that misses the point, is what you're saying, is that without basically the ability, like a baseline of self-sustenance from a manufacturing standpoint, we're at the mercy of the whim of the whims of any future.
Right. Don't put your supply lines in front of you. You want to have your supply lines behind you. That's why we can't do anything about Russia, because they have natural gas exports to Europe that Europe is dependent on. So we're constrained by that. And that's, you know, and I'm not saying that I'm not going to say that we should do one thing or another about Russia. I'm just saying.
Right. But that's an example. Right.
And so, you know, I don't think we should necessarily play the globetrotting cowboy policeman of the world, however you want to put it. But the point is that we have allowed other countries to have leverage over us. And you know, you might think that we should be more peaceful. And I do think that. But I'm also, you know, I don't necessarily think that other elites around the world have our interests at heart. And I don't think that they'll have any problem using leverage against us, leverage that we've given to them.
Now,
and we should.
I want to talk about sort of, you know, one of the things that concerns me about the TPP in terms of sort of the downward pressure on all sorts of environmental, labor, consumer standards. But could I take your argument and say that's an argument why we should be drill, baby drill type of thing?
I don't follow.
Well, in the sense that if, you know, should we be exploiting our carbon at this point? I mean, or is that a different calculation? Because we don't want to be, we want to be able to be self-sufficient insofar as energy.
I haven't thought about that question enough. I'm not sure. You know, the way that Ball was thinking about this was, you know, 67. So the country started importing, became a net importer of oil in 71, I think. I could be wrong about the date, but it was roughly around the time when Ball was talking about this. But America had not yet become dependent on foreign oil sources. And so I'm guessing that this question had emerged but was not urgent at the time.
No, but what I'm talking about is your concerns from a national security standpoint. I mean, vitamin C is produced by the Chinese. That concern, does that translate in terms of energy, or is that just basically an argument that we need to be, doing
well,
better?
Well, it's interesting you bring up energy. From what I understand, think about our various types of spending and regulatory policies and enormous investments in energy, right? And we have, you know, you could argue we've fought various wars for oil to ensure that flow of oil comes in. And I think you could make a pretty compelling argument that making sure that there's a flow of oil into the United States has been an end goal of our national security and industrial apparatus. You saw a lot of investment in fracking and things like that early 2004 and onward. And so we have a lot of people who are paying attention to oil and energy. We just don't have a lot of people paying attention to
everything
the supply
else.
Chains of multinationals and things like vitamin C. So we are, it's actually where we pay attention to things. Like with oil, it flows.
Interesting. And give me your sense. Are you when you look at something like the TPP? Are you also? I've heard examples of, you know, in terms of like the question of sovereignty that, the international tribunal that the TPP calls for instance, may determine that, you know, any move by Congress to negotiate with pharmaceutical companies, of drug prices for Medicare, that is out of bounds relative to the TPP, let's say, because it inhibits profits. I mean, is that type of scenario also problematic in your estimation?
Well, I don't. I mean, I can't really. I can. I mean, for the purpose of this conversation, I just sort of want to talk about the history here because the history is important.
Okay.
I'm not a. The trade law is really complicated, and I can't speak to that. I don't want to say one way or the other.
All right, fair enough. I mean, but when we talk about the structure, I guess specifics are difficult. But
there are better people to talk to about it who really know this stuff cold. I don't want to say things that aren't necessarily accurate. But I think that if you look at the point of these agreements, you know, going back when you can see that patent law and the laws that under which medicines were produced were different in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. And but the ideology of trade and this rhetoric of trade was developed then. And then as you've just like you've seen financial deregulation happened after this trading rhetoric was developed. A lot of the advances, the changes in patent law, the pharmaceutical industries, you know, ability to say advertise on television, that came after this. There's a lot of things that changed that were parallel to the trading regime, and that had consequences about what trade would mean. So even though these trade, you know, multinational supremacy was Ball's idea, in fact, offshoring of our industrial base didn't really happen. It happened in certain industries in the 70s, but it didn't happen wholesale until the early 80s through the mid 90s. So a bunch of things changed, and what is I think interesting about this trade rhetoric is that if we don't recognize that it is designed to limit sovereignty and have a discussion about sovereignty itself, and maybe you don't think sovereignty is necessarily a good thing, or maybe you think giving up some sovereignty for, say, a global reduction in carbon emissions would be a good thing. But we have to have that conversation about what these trading agreements mean, what these trading regimes really are about.
It's a great point, and it's fascinating stuff. All right, let me lastly ask, because you referenced in, I think, in part two, you know, semi-jokingly about, you know, those people who thought the UN was going to take over black helicopters, they were, you know, almost, you know, there was something to that. What has surprised me is that issue of sovereignty, which is not necessarily something on the left that is of number one concern. Maybe that's even an understatement. The opposition, and I think there was some, but it seemed that I anticipated a lot more opposition from the right to these trade agreements, which follow this, you know, structure, than I think I saw. I mean, maybe you saw more. I mean, what do you think that this will? I mean, that this is resonating on the right. I mean, I specifically remember doing interviews with people on the TPP, and, you know, asking after the interview, like, you got to get this to, you know, O'Reilly, because there's stuff there that, you know, his folks, I think, would assume would chew on, and they're like, they're just not interested.
Yeah, I mean, there are right wingers that I know who are definitely worried about. I mean, there's, you know, there are nationalists on the right,
right,
and for different reasons, they are worried. Not entirely different reasons. I mean, there's. But they are definitely, they fought NAFTA. I mean, Ross Perot is no left-winger.
Right.
And they have interests in national security. They have interests in a national industrial base. I mean, the ideas I'm putting forward about keeping your supply lines in front of you, that's from Alexander Hamilton, his report on manufacturers. Now, I'm not generally an admirer of Alexander Hamilton, but those ideas go back that far or further. I mean, he just saw how England managed to build an empire from a small island. And we should do what they're doing. And so you have, you know, some smart people on the right who, you know, who think that, you know, there is really serious problems when China is making a lot of our electronic components and they can put Trojan horses in them. And they understand that. And they're not afraid to say, hey, this is America. We should run it for American interests. What you do find, I think, in the liberal side is you find a lot more focus on economic inequality, but you know, the vast majority of the opposition to trade agreements comes from the Democratic side of the aisle. A lot of Republicans, you know, just like some Democrats, are, you know, they just reflexively buy into the ideology of free trade. This is not really about trade; it is about reducing sovereignty for geopolitical purposes.
Matt Stoller, fascinating stuff, and we will link to your Tumblr observations on credit and surveillance. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
All right, folks, we're going to take a break, head into the better half of the program. I hope that made sense, what I was saying about all of these pieces that Matt has written in the interview, which reminded me of that dynamic of how we sort of had the shell of what free trade was supposed to do, and it has sort of been stuffed with something vastly different in many respects. And part of that is a function of what has changed in terms of multinational corporations represent in our world today. Coming up in the better half, we will talk about the relentless onslaught of the Nazis, making themselves, recreating themselves in the form of people who want income equality in this country.
And we are here to close the capital gains loophole. We will not stop this.
That's right.
Can't see that.
We're jumping on board with
also,
this.
Also, a major discovery about the Big Bang Theory. I will read the report of it, and I can almost guarantee you I will not understand a single thing that I am talking about, in which case it means it doesn't really exist, and the world is only 6,000 years old, and God created it all. And speaking of which, apparently CNN has a new theory on the disappearance of that Malaysian plane, and it's obviously a fascinating story because no one can figure out what happened. But sweet Lord, it's also, I guess, a very slow news time. And the things that are now being entertained, I think actually just go to show you the development of what happens when there's no answer for something that everyone's interested in. And no sort of obvious answer. What fills the vacuum is just unbelievable. That and more, of course, we will take your phone calls, 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM me at Majority FM or on the app. You can pick up the app at majorityapp.com. Folks, this show relies on your membership to continue. You can become a member today at majority.fm. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it from our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Click on the Amazon link, bookmark it, always buy your Amazon crap through that. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Get 10% off with the coupon code Majority. We'll be back in just a moment.
Hey.